How you doing there? Just a quickie before we start. On the Apple podcast, why don't you double click on David McWilliams Plus? It's right there when you open the podcast. You get ad-free, you unlock early access. Just double click and away you go. David McWilliams Plus. You get this pure and simple.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
To understand the economy, you have to understand human nature.
This podcast is powered by Acast.
How are you doing there? It is time for the podcast that tries to make economics comprehensible, a little bit more intelligible, and hopefully a little bit more relevant to all your lives. Hope all is well. I'm a little bit hanging today, John.
Are you?
Yeah,
you have that look about you.
Yeah. It's difficult. It's the
droopiness.
It's the droopiness. It's like pushing a rock up a hill.
Yeah. Have you got those hot ears that
I've got the hot ears. I've got the hot ears, which is very bad. I don't know if anybody else gets the hot ears after a night in the tiles. If you do,
where were you?
I was in a really nice little place called Piper's Corner, which is on Marlborough Street.
Right.
Listening to, I was out with Dan Ariely. You know my old mate.
Yes. Yeah. You went for a tour to a diddly idly session.
Dan was really into diddly eye, right? So okay. He says to me, where should we go? So we strolled around to the cobblestone, was jammed. So we strolled up to Piper's Corner and there was a little diddly eye band, two girls and fella in the beginning. Yeah. What I loved, right? And of course, Dan is Israeli, so he's never seen any of this stuff, right?
Yeah.
But what I loved is the fact that players just kept a fellow with a
squeeze box. It just grows organically.
A fellow with a squeeze box comes in, another girl with a fiddle, a fellow with Ilan pipes, which I hadn't seen for a while, you know?
Yeah.
And then it's this little bar on Marlborough Street, Piper's Corner. It was jammers. And as you know, it changes the atmosphere completely.
Oh, absolutely. Live music, and particularly diddly idly music. As you know, I was always into a bit of diddly eye in my day.
Yeah, you were.
And worked on a lot of that stuff as a young fella. But there is something amazing about diddly eye music in terms of atmosphere.
And the foot's going, and you can't help yourself. And of course, the problem is the foot's going, the pints are going too. That's the problem. By the way, if you're not from Ireland, diddly eye is our affectionate term for Irish traditional music, which is extraordinary. We just call it diddly eye because it makes kind of sound like diddly eye.
That's it, yeah. And that's the other element of it is that, you know, after a while, it all starts blending and becoming the same.
Well, I think after a while, we start blending as well. that's the true thing.
Yeah.
And I was a real novice. I was getting my yup at the wrong time. I was looking at me, saying,
oh no,
don't
who's
you,
the rookie in the corner?
Yeah, don't you yup at the wrong time. I was yupping at jinx reels. Anyway, that was why I'm feeling a little bit under the weather, but I'm good for him. Good.
Listen, come here.
I'm here.
I've a bone to pick with the economists of the world.
Oh.
Or maybe not even the economists of the world. Maybe that's unfair.
Guilty as charged,
but
Your Honor. Go.
The Nobel Organization.
Oh, yes.
Awarding Bernanke.
Ben Bernanke,
the Nobel Prize, and his two
buddies. Other geezers, yeah.
One of them has a great set of sideburns on him. Great.
Well, listen, that's only a matter of time, John. You and I.
But awarding him the Nobel Prize for Economics for QE. No,
it's even worse than that, John.
Yes.
Yeah. It's actually awarding him the Nobel Prize for Economics for writing a paper that says money matters.
Okay? Ingenious, that is.
Okay.
So enlightened.
So, you know, from doing the podcast with me for the last couple of years, and I've written for a long time about the two most brilliant economists that I've ever studied were Minsky and Kindleberger.
Yeah.
Both of these economists understood that at the center of the economic system is money and the banking system.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. And they also understood that you cannot look at the modern Western economy going back to the Industrial Revolution without understanding the role of money.
Makes sense.
Mainstream economics, particularly articulated by the Chicago School, of which Bernanke is one, said that money didn't matter. Most economic, can you imagine this, John, right? I'm going to let you into a little story here. Most economic models don't have a variable for money, or didn't until 2008. So they looked at the real economy without looking at money, right?
So, that just doesn't make sense.
So Minsky was saying, hold on a second. But Minsky and Kindleberger were both ostracized by mainstream economics, both of them. Minsky because he never wrote in mathematics, and Kindleberger because they never wrote in mathematics. They always are, this is the way the world works, right?
Right, okay.
By the way, if you're interested, Kindleberger's book called Mania, Booms and Panics is absolutely, it's actually over there, it's over there on the wall. It's essential, right? Anyway, Bernanke writes this paper, says, do you know what? Do you know, come here, I'll tell you something. Money matters. Now, I'll tell you this story. In the summer of 2008, before our economy collapsed, one of the main government forecasters, the main institution that forecasts this economy, gave me a call, and I'd worked these people in the central bank years ago, so I know them all, right?
Yeah.
And I'd been writing, but not just me, the man on the street knew, right?
Yeah.
That, look, if the banks go bust, it's going to be pretty scary. Or if the housing market goes bust, there's going to be a credit crunch.
Yeah.
If there's a credit crunch, there's going to be a balance sheet recession. You know, we're going to look at something that looks really horrific. The main forecaster rang me and said, David, do you think there's going to be a problem and a link between what's happening in the credit markets and the real economy? I said to myself, are you fucking serious? In my head.
Yeah.
They had no
idea. Why didn't you say that out loud?
They had no idea. So,
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, it's mad. Okay, now it's all been reappraised, right?
But this is what he's been awarded for.
So he's been awarded for telling people that money matters, right? How pathetic is that? And what it basically is doing is it is making legitimate decades of economic research and Nobel Prizes given to people who didn't know that money mattered. This is the worst thing.
Yeah.
Who wouldn't believe it? But the interesting thing is Bernanke sent his paper to Kindleberger in 1982. And here is a letter on the 1st of May, 1982, from Kindleberger to Bernanke. So Bernanke's a young fellow at this stage.
Yeah.
Sent his paper because Kindleberger was known to be the guy who understood all this thing.
Right.
And the response is from Kindleberger. Okay, Charles Kindleberger, by the way, we're talking about. Dear Dr. Bernanke, thank you for sending me your paper on the Great Depression. You ask for my comments, and I assume this is not merely ceremonial. I'm afraid you will not, in fact, welcome them. I think, now this is just...
There's an opener.
I think you have provided a most ingenious solution to a non-problem.
Wow.
Right?
What a slap down.
The necessity to demonstrate that financial crisis can be deleterious to production arises only in the scholastic precincts of the Chicago School. And he goes on to destroy them.
Jesus.
So that's the great man.
Yeah.
Talking to the guy who's going to become the head of the Fed, who now got the Nobel Prize.
Wow.
Economics, you are on trial. You're in the dock and you are, John, guilty as charged by John Davis.
Absolutely. But I mean, actually, is there a link then between that Bernanke way of thinking and the Bank of England and the Brexiteers? And did they
make huge
connections or fail to make those connections?
They fail. Like, I mean, it's interesting you talk about the financial crisis. Queen of England, right? Did go into the Bank of England. She was at some sort of do in the Mansion House in England just after the crisis. And she mused aloud to all these economists, if you chaps were so clever, why didn't you see this coming? It was a fairly good thing. And the reason they didn't see it coming was they believed all this nonsense. They'd actually gone to the Ivory Tower. They'd stayed in the Ivory Tower. They digested all this stuff. I go on, I'll read you what more Kindleberger says, right? He said, blah, 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 on the Chicago School. If one believes in rational expectations, a natural rate of unemployment, efficient markets, and exchange rates that continuously lie at purchasing power, there is not much that can be explained about the business cycle or financial crisis. For a Chicagoan, he's talking to Bernanke, you are courageous to depart from the assumption of complete markets. And he's basically saying that you believed nonsense. And therefore your paper is of no consequence. It's not revealing anything that the man in the street doesn't understand. And yet the Nobel Prize was given to him for such a thing.
I'd love to have seen Bernanke's face when he's reading that.
Exactly. Anyway, we digress. The UK, John.
Indeed. Well, that's what I was saying, is that link.
And I think you know what we've got to say at the top is, I had a couple of English friends staying with us last weekend.
Mm.
They are traumatized.
Yes.
You know, yeah. English people are, you know, I actually feel...
My brother's still over there, as you know.
I feel incredibly sorry for them now, because they're just looking at, as you call it, the shit show. And they're thinking, what? Now they have a new chancellor.
Yes, that's the truth. Well, you know, for this week anyway.
They have a new chancellor. They've had five chancellors since 2019. We've had five chancellors since 1997.
Wow. That's saying something.
It shows you the chaos. But
maybe we should have had more.
We should have had 20. Exactly. So Jeremy Hunt is the new chancellor.
Mm.
I'm going to tell you a story about Jeremy Hunt.
Go on.
To me by Brian Eno, name dropping, right?
Right.
Brian Eno's daughter is a doctor.
Right.
And Jeremy Hunt used to be the health secretary. And I don't know if you remember, a couple of years ago, junior doctors in the UK went on strike.
Yes.
Because they were being overworked, right? And they were all told, when you go on strike, get banners, because the TV will be there, right? Banners saying what you're striking about. And Brian Eno's daughter, with Brian Eno's help, I think, wrote a banner.
Yeah.
And Jeremy Hunt was the Secretary of Health.
Yeah.
And the banner read, "I'm not a gynecologist, but I recognize a hunt when I see one."
Brilliant.
I love it. Chapeau to Brian Eno and his daughter.
Did he get it on TV?
It's just great. Anyway, yes, they're in a bit of a pickle. They are in a major, major pickle. It's very, very hard to see how they get out of it. Like, for example, they announced at the weekend that their corporation tax would go up to 25%.
Yes, yeah, yeah. So it was yet another U-turn.
But I mean, it means, for example, that British corporation tax is now twice as high as Irish corporation tax.
Yes.
Yeah. Flood of companies going to come here. Why wouldn't they? We've got access to Europe, they don't.
Yeah.
We've got corporation tax, which is half of theirs.
Yeah. We don't have housing though, Mac.
But we always come back to that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I know.
But I'll give you another statistic, which is amazing. Britain has a population of 60 million. And last year they raised 55 billion, which is a lot of money, in corporation tax.
Yeah, yeah.
Ireland has a population of 5 million. And last year we raised corporation tax of 20 billion. So it means that Ireland...
Yeah.
Has less than a tenth of the population, or around a tenth, less than a tenth of the population of the UK, and raises, think about this, raises 30% of what the UK raises.
Yeah.
Corporations.
It's incredible, actually.
It is incredible.
But we spoke about this in a previous podcast. Maybe for people who haven't heard that, you can have a listen back from a few weeks ago when we talked about the perils of that as well.
The perils of that, yeah. I mean, that's an imbalance, right?
Yeah.
But it shows you what's going to happen in the UK. So basically, we come back to it again and again and again, that good countries, and I say this because my English mates are really, I mean, they're just reeling. They don't know what the hell's going on, right?
Yeah.
None of them voted for this.
Voted for Truss anyway, apart from the little cabal of conservatives.
And their country is being destroyed in front of their eyes.
Yeah.
You know? And so, you know, you do feel sorry for them. Like initially I was like, this is kind of interesting and kind of funny for our perspective, right?
Yeah.
But now it's actually getting to the stage that, hold on a second, somebody's got to grab that country by the scruff of the neck and turn it around. So let's just go and talk to Mark Blythe, get his take, but let's be aware that although it's like a horror show over there, it's both instructive, because it could happen anywhere else, and it's cautionary. So we have to be aware. Well, let's go and talk to Mark. It's very rare that I go to a place where I have been many, many, many years ago as a pathetically bad dishwasher in Martha's Vineyard. But Mark Blythe is there, but you're not washing dishes. You're the swanky pants professor of the Ivy League world. How is the Vineyard? I haven't been there for years and years and years.
They haven't recovered from when you were here. The local economy is still a shambles.
But you know, it's funny. I was looking at, was it Marco Rubio or one of those guys deposited a whole load of Honduran or Mexican immigrants in Marco's Vineyard? What was that last week, was it?
Yeah, it was DeSantis, the Florida governor, bussed them all up and then flew them up and dumped them here.
I know. And I just thought to myself, I was listening to that on The Daily by the New York Times. I was walking the dog the other day and I was thinking, a whole bunch of Hondurans is nothing like an invasion of Irish kids in 1988 in terms of the trauma that we left.
J1 in hand.
Exactly. Or even in my case, no J1. I couldn't be arsed getting one. I just turned up illegally. But anyway, tell me, you're in the vineyard, which is the playground of the uber rich, which is delighted that we're talking to you. I realise now that you've actually elevated yourself. Are the Obamas around the corner?
No, we're at the other end of the island next to a house that looks like Darth Vader's helmet.
Listen, Mark, let's talk about the United Kingdom. Give me your take on the United Kingdom. We have been having a little bit too much of a laugh at their expense, but now I realise, hold on a second, this is now getting very, very serious. In the beginning, it was like, oh my God, look what's happening over there. That's a shit show.
Yeah.
Kind of funny, interesting, etc. Boris Johnson going, etc. But now I'm looking at their bond market. I'm looking at their pension fund. I'm looking at sterling. I'm looking at current account deficits. I'm looking at budget deficits. I'm looking at the Bank of England all over the shop. I'm looking at nobody at the wheel. And we have all the various iterations of nationalism and regionalism and all the stuff we talked about before. What's your take on your home island?
Since 1986, the British pound has been mysteriously overvalued. It has been bought and held and speculated with by foreigners. So much so that 7% of global reserves are sterling. And sterling as a country is 3% of the globe's GDP. Nobody needs to hold sterling. The only reason you're doing this is because it's a convenient hedge and it gives you access to the big markets in London. It also allows you to launder huge amounts of money through their property markets and other such things. And this has been a really nice trick, but it's all based upon one thing, competence. It's all based upon the notion that you know what you're doing. It's all based upon the notion that it's safe to keep your money there. And once you lose confidence, whether it's through the bond markets, through the financial markets more broadly, through the political markets, if you want, or a confluence of all three, then you're in trouble. Now, this is why this is particularly toxic for the United Kingdom. The UK imports 2/3 of its food. The way that this expresses itself is when people stop buying those financial assets or they become more costly to service them, they exit. And when they exit, the exchange rate goes down and the cost of your imports goes up, which means your inflation problem is endemic and increasing. And if you're going to basically throw fuel on the fire with huge unfunded tax cuts on top of that, you are basically saying, we do not know what we're doing. And that's what everyone reacted to. It's a dumpster fire.
Now, I'm going to break this down a bit. So I've always thought, well, it's not I've always thought, it's, I've always observed that sterling is much more, or the UK is much more inherently inflationary. And I think that always comes from the fact that the UK always uses their currency at the end in a sort of a very hydraulic Keynesian way to get out of a problem, okay? So the currency falls. And I think that having worked over there, I was always intrigued in the city that economists over there all saw the exchange rate as the policy of last resort. Okay, when all else fails, you let the currency fall. This is what they're doing. But I find it fascinating you say they import their food, and that is crucial. So the poorest people who spend a higher proportion of their monthly or weekly income on food are getting hit hardest.
Exactly. So I'm writing a book on inflation just now, and I'll give you a wee story that I got from Isabella Weber, the German economist. So her mum grew up in a small town in southern Germany, on a fixed budget, single mum. And that meant any inflation at all was something that was felt instantly in the household. But she's got a friend who's also a single mum who got a big divorce settlement. And she buys the nice stuff that she can't normally afford. She's got less of a budget constraint, if you want to put it in the language of economics. And here's what happened this summer. Because people are worried about their budgets, they're not buying things like strawberries and champagne. And what that means is there's too much of those things around. So relatively speaking, the price falls. So the rich person in the village now has more champagne and strawberries because of the inflation effect
Precisely.
On everybody else
Precisely.
Who's getting screwed. Right? So we think of this as like one number 9% and we're all suffering 9%. No, no, no. Not at all. It varies massively
sure.
and it's usually the poor who get screwed the most.
Well, it's very interesting here. Very interesting. I remember in the last big downturn here in Ireland, some politician was talking about GDP and somebody responded about whose GDP? Yours or mine? And it's exactly the same as inflation. Whose inflation? Yours or mine? So an actual fact, and interesting about Isabella Weber, I'll just say, listeners, if you don't know, she has actually just come up with an extraordinary victory, which has been to persuade the German parliament to adopt significant price caps rather than allowing energy prices rise and then clawing it back with some sort of tax rebate. In fact, Isabella, who I want to get on the show, has actually been cussed, dogged, and unbelievably effective as saying, hold on a second, once you let inflation get out of control, even if you claw it back, the psychological angst and dislocation that comes from the initial price rise lingers and affects people. So, extraordinary person, and we'll definitely have on the show. Let's get to the UK now. What is your prognosis for the next wee while? You spoke on the show about a year ago about the fundamental disequilibrium in the United Kingdom. That isn't going away. This has just been evidenced by recent events. Can they get out of it? If not, what does it look like?
You have to put this in the context of what they've done to themselves for the past decade and a half. So you start in 2008 by basically bailing out asset holders and then screwing the poor. That's what happened. That then fragilises massively northern governments in particular. Preston lost 30% of his budget. And think about all the social transfers that keep places like that going. So then you engender the anger and you weaponise the anger in a direction that's useful to you through Brexit. So then you do all the bullshit about it's going to change everything. Now, there was a moment with people like Cummings. Now, he may not have been the right guy in the right place, but he was actually saying something interesting. The old business model where we basically rely on the City of London to generate a credit surplus, which we then push through the rest of the economy and we swap houses with each other, that's done. We need to find a new way of earning a living in this world. And he was thinking that. But unfortunately, the rest of the Tory party were just pretending that's what they're doing. So that opportunity was squandered. You limp along again. You get into the situation with COVID. You then basically massively increase the indebtedness of the state, fair enough, because the alternative is a huge catastrophic downturn. But then when you come out of it, you then get into this ludicrous situation of, on top of this, we're going to have massive cuts. They don't know what to do. The pathology is the British business model, such as it is, it's kind of broken. And there are functioning companies and there are functioning pockets of entrepreneurship and great tech and all the rest of it. But the basic model of essentially what you'd call asset protection for the South and nationalism for the North is a toxic combination which has come unstuck. And if you can't even do the asset protection for the South anymore,
precisely,
you're in deep trouble.
And that's where they are.
Because
Southern balance sheets have been destroyed. And the housing market is going to tank at 5%. You know, at 5% mortgage rates, 6% mortgage rates, the debts that were incurred in the last 10, maybe even 12 years are going to be monumental.
Absolutely. I mean, if you think about it, somebody who's on 850 a month just now, push it up to 6%, they're on 1,400. So yeah, that's £1,000 of post-tax income in order to pay that. Where are they getting that? Nobody seems to know. And your fuel cap's not going to help if all you're doing with your fuel cap is shoveling more money to energy companies rather than trying to do what Isabella Weber's doing and basically do it through price caps at the front end rather than just paying off companies in the back end. So, yeah, that's not looking pretty and it's not clear what they're going to do. Now, of course, the tragedy here is that the Labour Party strategy seems to be say nothing, do nothing, don't screw up and eventually I'll be elected, which is not exactly channeling what their new business model is. Now, out of the conference, there's some good ideas there. Sovereign Wealth Fund for Britain, for future investment, green tech, all the rest of it, something I've been championing for a long time with Eric Lonergan. So there's some good ideas there, but do they grasp the gravity of the situation? Do they realise that the cupboard is going to be pretty bare when they get in and they're going to spend a lot of time restoring credibility and essentially, you know, putting Humpty Dumpty back together again? But do you actually have the wherewithal to transform Humpty Dumpty?
And, you know, what is fascinating here is all this conversation is about a lack of vision for the future, a lack of somebody looking around the world, maybe doing a bit of travelling, maybe reading a few books, maybe talking to a few people and say, OK, what is going on in the world and where is our little niche that we can make a few quid in 20 years' time, in 10 years, in 20 years' time, OK? Rather than that, Mark, it seems to me that they're all looking backwards.
That the
inspiration is coming from somewhere else. Well, you've thought about this quite a bit.
All countries are doing it in a weird way, right? The first one that made me think this way was the United States, because the Supreme Court decision over abortion, and then Clarence Thomas turns around and says, and now we have to go back through these other precedents. And it's like, well, what's the imaginary of the world you want? A completely gerrymandered democracy with an authoritarian ruler and basically racist policing? This is it. So back to the 1870s, you know, that seems to be the model there. Truss, if it was only just for the hysterical funniness of actually dressing up like Thatcher and then trying to do it again, it's just another monumental piece. I mean, Martin Wolf wrote about this in the Times. I mean, it's so blindingly obvious. Once you've privatised the housing stock, you can't do it again. right? Once you've liberalised banking and given everybody a credit card, you can't do it again. So what exactly is Thatcherism 2, right? So everybody seems to be stuck in this kind of like governing by looking backward to some, like Brexit. Brexit's a classic example of this, right? Going back to some halcyon past where, you know, we had all these great free trade deals. So you mean what, with the biggest free trade area on the planet, which is the EU, which you've just left? I mean, it's bonkers. So it is this kind of governing by ass backward nostalgia.
And which is the same, like, I mean, to bring in our friend Putin, I mean, he's Peter the Great. He's actually said, this is my model, you know? And where does that come from? Let's say the politics and economics of nostalgia at a time when the world is hurtling forward at an extraordinary pace, okay? Where does that come from? Explain that to me from with your political hat on.
I think it comes from the fact that the world's too damn complex. Nobody really knows how it works. We've got intuitions for little bits, but I mean, you know, nobody had even heard the words liability-driven investment last week until it became the thing we were talking about. So all, you know, COVID, et cetera, all these shocks, it's incredibly complex. And it's also a world in which when you're an economist, you're taught to think that the world works like this. Shocks are independent, right? So an oil shock is different from a climate shock, right? And they're normally distributed. That is to say, they don't all hit you at once. And we seem to live in a world where your oil shock does cause a climate shock, which then causes another shock. And they're not at all normally distributed. They're all coming at once. Adam Tooze has called this the poly crisis. And it's a good way of describing it because all these things happening at once. And I think that our kind of like 19th and 20th century institutions of government basically can't handle it. They can't process it. They don't know what to do with it. So they retreat to first principles. What's worked in the past? Where do we want to be? Where's our safe space? Honestly, it's almost like a search for a safe space for governance.
So it seemed to me that you're kind of moving towards sort of an evolutionary approach, a sort of complex adaptive system approach that basically, you know, look at the economy like the immune system. That's this alive, intelligent creature that's constantly adapting all the time and taking information and changing. And we're all sort of evolving at this time. But that's some intellectually an interesting idea. Mm-hmm. But in terms of politics, in terms of dislocated people...
It doesn't help you, does it? No, you're absolutely
right. So where do you go?
It doesn't help you. So concentrate on one big thing. The one big thing that we know that we need to do is basically decarbonize. And if you do this, you will generate the new technologies, the new industries, the new sources of employment. You will transform the business model of everyone. And it's 100% incentive to do this because if you don't, we're all dead, right? So just focus on one thing. If you start doing the short-term thing of like, oh, but in America, we can't let the gas price go above $5. Why not? If you want to subsidize the people who are hurting the most from that, you have other ways of doing that, right? You could simply take the child tax credit that was rolled out in the pandemic and then give it to everybody who files a tax return under $50,000. Done, right?
Done.
There's your fuel subsidy if you want to do that way, right? There's loads of ways to do this, but it would have to be in the service of the one big project, which to me has to be and really should be decarbonisation. Otherwise, you're just going to get drowned in the details. It's going to be whack-a-mole. You're going to be constantly like, oh, let's hit this thing. Oh, look, another one's come up. Let's hit this thing. And you just got to stay focused on where you want to go with this.
And tell us, that's a very long-term deal. And I was interested, we had Neil Atkinson, who used to be the head of oil at the International Energy Agency last week. And he was saying, look, David, I'm with you on the carbon. But he says, for now, India, China, and particularly Africa will continue to burn liquid fuels. And there's this idea of, you know, we always said like the idea that, well, of procrastination. Like, yeah, I really want to do this, but you know what, right? Not now. Yourself and Eric Lonergan wrote a fantastic book 2 or 3 years ago now called Angrynomics. And it was like a sort of a Socratic, if that's not a bit too pretentious, discussion between two fellas talking nonsense. But it wasn't nonsense. You focused on what can be done to decarbonize. And you focused on central banking and you focused on using the finance system and you focused on all sorts of things. Now, you tweeted the other day that there was a great opportunity to decarbonize at 0% interest rates. We've kind of pissed that up against the wall. But what now?
Well, you can still do it, right? If you're a cost of capital, so long as the thing you're investing in has a positive return, if you wipe out inflation, basically you're still streets ahead. You can still do this at the interest rates we've got. It is more a question of just mobilizing that massive private sector balance sheet to go this way. And instead, what we have, particularly in the US, is this emerging war on woke capitalism, whereby anybody who says the words ESG or tries to talk about climate-friendly investment is somehow a communist and needs to be shut down. Now, to go back to your mate on the oil thing, right? I think that actually is not a great way of looking at things, because it's a bit like saying the following. In the 1990s, Africa and India, they're going to need telephones. They're going to be using copper wire for a very long time. No, they went straight to mobile.
That's true.
And there's loads of ways that these latecomers, in a sense, have those advantages of being backward, in the sense that you can then adopt the latest technology and plug and play. And these technologies...
Didn't like me and John going to the pub on a Friday night when all the other lads have had 7 pints and you take one look and say, man, maybe not.
Yes, exactly.
There's actually an easier way of negotiating this evening than trying to catch up saying, I'm actually going to have 8 pints now. In 1 hour, I'm going to have 8 pints and I'm going to tequila and I'm going to get right up to your level. This is my approach to economics. It's always like, okay, we take carbon neutral budgets, we take thing, and I say, okay, what does it look like in the boozer on a Friday night at 10 past 10? You walk in, there's 8 mates are 9 pints to the good. Yeah. You say, I'm going home.
Yeah.
Our actual That's fact, exactly. I don't have to join them. There's a better way of exiting the night than having 10 yes. pints.
What I can do is I can go home and have some mushrooms instead. It's so much better, right?
Well, actually, the funny thing is I was about to say that when I was at Martha, the last time I was in Martha's Vineyard, it was in a mushroom haze.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I was 19 and off my head, strolling around. And there's actually a particularly nice playground in the middle of Martha's Vineyard. It might still be there. And I thought
the
swings were particularly nice that night.
Yes. It's now known as the David McWilliams Trip Playground.
Now, listen, let's get back to the UK. Because we have been looking at the UK the last couple of weeks. Bizarrely, Ireland has decoupled from the UK to such an extent that now it's actually a spectator sport for us. But it's not for our farmers. But the thing about the UK, as you said, because they can't feed themselves,
They've got to import,
right? It's not really for our tourist sector, because again, come summer again, the UK will be a big, big tourism. And of course, we've got Northern Ireland, this conundrum. Okay, let's say conundrum, right? And of course, we've got your lads as well, the Scots, not knowing which way to go, right? Or which way they're going to go, right? But how do you put this Humpty Dumpty back together again? That's what I'm asking you. And how long does it take? And what's the fallout? Because what I'm looking at, and I've said it before, you know, good countries can go bad with very bad politics. The UK might not have been a good country, but it wasn't a bad bloody country, right? Mm-hmm. And now it looks like a disastrous country. As you said, we start with competence. Let's go back to competence. How does a country regain competence?
So the problem with regaining competence, I'll give you an example of this. Ed Balls put out a tweet where he said, what Kwasi Kwarteng has done is basically rip up 30 years of like the consensus on how you do policy. And the problem with that statement is it says, A, there are no choices to make. It's already, we've got the plan, we know what we're doing. And it's not as if the past 30 years were so great. So I'm not sure it's such a great plan. Second thing is, if we do live in this world now, which is basically one where shocks are not independent, not normally distributed, and you're facing all these things at once, it's not clear to me that that, going back to the old strip works, that simply talking to the Bank of England about independence, etc., that's for the 1990s.
Yeah, it's very 1990s. It's very New Labour stuff.
It's very 1990s, right? So then what does it mean to actually do something different? So let's not be cynical about trust for a minute. And let's think about the fact that from the limited repertoire of what was available to the libertarian side of the Conservative Party, that was an attempt to break the business model. That was an attempt to try and do something different. And everyone said, no, no, don't do it, don't do it. And I agree, because I think it's a ludicrous way of doing it. But having the recognition that we just can't go on doing what we've doing because this thing has run out of steam and run aground and isn't working for the vast majority of Brits, that's where any government needs to start. And what worries me about Labour in particular is like they're literally saying now, do you can trust us? We are fiscally competent. Like, do you really want to like face the 21st century with fiscal competence as your first thing?
Yeah, they're like Fine Gael with a bit of Marxism thrown into it.
Very little Marxism. I think you find more Marxism in Fine Gael.
Exactly. There probably is. But so you're saying that they need to come up with some big, significant shift. And the idea should be, if you just, let's go back, and it's the same for Ireland as well. We are living in a sort of a Martha's Vineyard with shitty weather. Imagine that, right? That's Ireland. We have wind, we have wave, we have renewables. We have all this there. But we don't seem to, in this country, have decided, okay, our industrial policy is going to be, for the next 30 years, we are going to be the best at harnessing wind, at putting together a network, at exporting it. You know, putting all the state's energy in the same way as the Koreans did. If you look at, and you know, Ha Jung Chang is coming down to Kilponomics, his book on the 23 things they don't tell you about capitalism, what he's basically saying is that great countries foster great industries. So the Koreans, they didn't go down the free market route. They didn't say, oh, do you know what, open it all up like Russia. Nor did the Chinese. And in fact, Isabella Weber's book is all about how the Chinese said, you can stuff your sharp shock. We're going to go slowly. We're going to build national champions. We're going to give them subsidized capital. We're going to give them subsidized labor. We're going to protect them. And then when they're ready to go, we're going to open up.
Exactly.
That's the model for us.
So there's so if you think about what Biden's doing now, whenever Biden opens his mouth, he cannot help himself but to say, and this will create great union jobs. And you're like, look, mate, I'm a big fan of this as well, but 9% of the labor force are in unions in the private sector in the United States. So who are you actually talking to? And the ideas that they have now about a national development bank and strategic funds, the CHIPS Act, all this sort of stuff, it's a redux of what they tried to do in the 1980s before the free market fundamentalists took over the shop. So we are, in a sense, going back again. Now, the thing is, are the only two alternatives we've got some kind of state-led green industrial policy or the libertarian free market? Is that it? Is that our only options? I think this is where you have to really look at this on a kind of a country-specific basis. What Ireland would do is going to be very different from what France can do. They all start in different places, right? They've got different ingredients. And I think what we need to do is kind of, and this is something Eric and I talked about in Angrynomics, is we fear nationalism because it's a horrible exclusionary ideology, which is borderline, if not overtly racist. Fine. But the fact of nations and the fact of national economies allows for a degree of experimentation whereby somebody's going to crack something and we're all going to go, oh, that's interesting. Look what the Irish managed to do. Let's scale this up. And that's what we need. We need kind of like less of the, how can I put it, worrying about what the overarching mega plan is and actually just let people and firms and businesses and countries do it. Get on there, create the incentives to make it work.
I remember, I'm just going to leave on this. It's on that particular issue of, you know, I like that idea of recipes, that every nation has its own little flavor and the flavoring's quite different. Obviously, we will not lecture anybody in this country on food or anything like that.
So
we will
you on cooking.
Cooking, or even on me on cooking, because it's well known that I am a tea and toast man. Tea and toast and maybe an else scrambled egg. And that's like the height of it. But Eric Lonergan made this very, very good point, which was that when Ireland became independent in 1922, by 1932, 86% of all our electricity energy was sustainable. Because the guys who got in, they said, we have a big river called the Shannon. And it was actually Michael Collins was actually talking about this. There's a company called Siemens that seems to be able to dam these things and actually build these things. And if we do this, what we're going to do is we're going to express nationalism, not in a screw the Brits, but we're going to express nationalism as we can bring free electricity to you, to everybody. Mm-hmm. And that's what the nationalists can do. So is that what you're saying? The national project can be seen as something enlightened, a specific dynamic, and for the good of the people.
Yeah, and particularly, I mean, imagine the difference that it made electrifying parts of rural Ireland. I mean, when you go in and you actually switch on the light at night, right? I mean, it's transformative of people's lives and what they can do and how they think about the world. And what have we done instead? Let's give bankers an even bigger bonus. I mean, it's truly pathetic. But you're hitting exactly on the right point, David, right? We need something that's going to inspire because we're in a period in which it's too easy to channel fear. It's too easy to channel cynicism and distrust. And when you have people like Liz Truss, which rhymes with distrust, I mean, you know, come on, it's even simpler. But, you know, jokes aside, we need to stop this. We need to actually say, yeah, there's a lot of challenges out there, but we need to work together in such a way that it actually benefits ordinary people or it's never going to happen. It's not about grand ideologies. It's about getting stuff done.
Listen, a pleasure, Mark. We'll see you soon.
Always a pleasure, my friend.
Fascinating stuff. He's brilliant. He's just absolutely brilliant. But let's pick apart some of the points he made and talk about what's going on in America and interest rates and how what's happening in the UK can happen anywhere.
Yeah.
But let's pay some bills first.
Always a good idea.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Do you know what Mark was saying there? What I was thinking is, like, the UK is almost like a functioning alcoholic, like drunk on ego and nostalgia. Mark was talking about nostalgia there a lot. And of course, nostalgia and looking back is not sustainable. And he's talking about UK needs to find a new business model.
Yeah.
To transform the economy.
Yeah, it does.
And we can't be looking back. You need to be looking forward with vision.
Nostalgia is incredibly dangerous because people's memories play tricks on them, right?
Yeah.
Everyone's memory. Like, you know, we all try to memorize the good things.
Yeah.
And so we have a rose-tinted view of our past, right? And if you think of humans, we're only a collection of memories.
Yeah.
Added a bit of water and a few neurons. But that's what we kind of are, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And nostalgia is incredibly dangerous because the bits that you pick from the past are the nice bits. The beautiful thing about Ireland is, you know, we don't do nostalgia at all because the past was shite.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, the Brits can say, oh, we'll go back to the 1950s when we ruled the world. I mean, go back to the 1950s when we were terrorised by the Catholic Church. We had no money. 500,000 Irish people emigrated to England alone in the 1950s.
So the great thing
about having a shite past is you don't want to go back there. So I've always thought that Ireland is quite a modern country. Tends to look forward quite a bit, right? Mm. Now, of course, all those...
And so that's only a recent phenomenon.
That's why I think that all these anniversaries, you know, Michael Collins and all this sort of stuff, yeah, remember it, but move on the hell.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying, John, is that nostalgia is dangerous because nostalgia plays tricks on us.
Mm.
And therefore we don't really understand what happened because we're so selective. But what he was saying is that, you know, in the United States, you have Make America Great Again.
Mm.
That is a nostalgic thing.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Take back control. These are nostalgic things. Take it back again. Even the words that are deployed are all harking back to something that was a better time.
Yeah.
I mean, what I find extraordinary about the United Kingdom is that the United Kingdom, what's happening in the UK, right? So basically what has happened is the world has changed in the last 6 months, actually since the invasion of Ukraine.
Yeah.
That the price of energy has gone up. And that has dramatically and unexpected, because nobody expected the war in Ukraine, right? And that has driven up the rates of inflation everywhere. Now the rates of inflation are so high, like in the United States, right, in the US, inflation this week was published for September.
Yeah.
And it shows that inflation in the US is running at 8.2%. Core inflation has risen by 0.4% month on month. Now what that means is inflation is accelerating. It's not decelerating. So it means the Fed, in order to bring inflation down to 2%, has to increase real interest rates quite dramatically.
Yeah.
So at the moment, Chicago futures, which is basically a futures market that tells you where interest rates are going to be in 3 months' time, is saying that American interest rates will be at 4.8%, so 5% Fed funds in December.
Wow, okay.
And it's talking about Fed funds 6% in June.
Mm.
Now that totally changes the game. Because remember we talked about margin calls? Remember this idea of margin calls? So the entire financial system, what is extraordinary about the financial system is nobody really knows where borrowing ends and lending starts. Everybody is borrowed and lent, right? So banks are lent to private equity. They're lent to developers. Yeah. Developers are then taking rent from us.
Yeah.
We as depositors lend money to the banks, but we also borrow money from the banks in mortgages or in, you know, car loans, etc. Yeah. So the entire system is based on borrowing and lending. And the fundamental foundational price, of course, is the rate of interest.
Yeah.
When that goes up, everything falls. Remember last year we were saying, look, you know, to people, young people buying houses, just hold off. Yeah. Hold off. There's too much going on now. House prices will fall by about 20%. Because interest rates will rise so dramatically that all asset prices, it's not that there's anything unique with this, all asset prices will have to fall.
Did Bernanke see this coming?
No, he was in Chicago in an ivory tower.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Exactly, right? So if you think about what's going on, like the margin calls that will be demanded in the financial markets in the next 3 or 4 months because of these increase in the rates of interest, because of the fall in the price of assets, are going to be phenomenal. Now, that's why the UK matters. Because what's happening in the UK, so what is happening in the UK gilt market is, and we touched on with Jumana a couple of weeks ago, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's back again, right? So basically what's happening is pensions, let's say you and I decide we want a pension. So we go to a pension outfit and that pension outfit says, okay, let's do a 30-year, well, in our vintage, that would be like a two-year pension, right? But let's say we're younger, right?
A two-year pension. Exactly.
They say, okay, in 30 years' time, I'll give you back X, right? Yeah. So they make a 30-year promise. In order to make good on that promise, they have to find a 30-year asset, right?
Yes.
So basically they say, I'll give you money back, and I'm going to find an asset that generates money over the 30-year period, right?
Mm.
So they buy a UK government IOU, which is a gilt, right? For 30 years. But the problem is when interest rates were so, so low, all the time, that the yield on those gilts was very, very modest. So that couldn't keep the pension fund manager in skiing holidays and fine wines and houses in Fox Rock and all that sort of thing, right? So what they had to do, and the Irish pension funds are the same, carry on, right?
Yeah.
In order to get a decent income, when yields are very small, you have to buy loads of those things with the small yields. So you add up all the yields and you start to get a decent income, right?
Yeah.
So they then started to borrow, what is called repo, to the banking system. So the bank said, okay, fine. And they bought gilts from the banks, but with borrowed money.
Mm.
And they bought it all on margin, right?
Right.
So now when the price of gilts, of bonds, is falling, the people who borrowed have to come up with hard cash in order to pay the margin.
The margin call,
and this is precisely what's happened to the UK pension funds. So the UK pension funds are now going bust, right? And that's why the Bank of England is in trying to buy gilts to force back up the price so they won't go bust. But the problem is, when you have an inflation rate of 10%, you need to be tightening monetary policy, not loosening. Buying gilts is loosening monetary policy. Okay, they're injecting cash in.
So
they're caught in this policy dissonance where they should be doing A, but they have to do B to protect the financial system. So amazingly, the financial system is completely at odds with the financial policymaker, because inflation is going the other way.
How did it get out of this, though?
It's incredibly hard for them to get out of it.
Yeah.
It's incredibly hard. The only way they'll get out of it is sterling weakens dramatically. If the housing market, they will have to have a huge recession in the UK. It's inconceivable for me as an economist to see how you get out of this. Because if the Bank of England continues to buy gilts to support the pension fund industry, what it's doing is it's loosening monetary policy.
Yeah.
When it's loosening monetary policy, it means the rate of interest can't go up. But if the rate of interest doesn't go up, the rate of inflation won't come down. So they're caught in a classic monetary cul-de-sac. Now, that's England. And everyone says, okay, but that's the UK, it's a special case because Liz Truss and the five chancellors and, you know, Brexit and la, 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 la.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's all in the terrible mix. That's a terrible policy mix. But imagine now, interest rates at 6% next year in America. That means what they call the risk-free rate in the world is 6%. So you're starting at 6%. It means the Eurozone will either have to have an incredibly weak euro, or we'll have to increase interest rates to match the Americans.
Right.
Now, I think what we're going to do...
What's desirable for us?
Much more, the weak euro. Much, much more desirable, right?
Because Spain?
So basically, when you look at, forget Ireland for a second. When you look at the Eurozone is almost a closed economy. We do most of our trade with each other. So Germany trades with France trades with Italy trades with Spain.
Right.
So that means that the rate of inflation is internally generated by something like energy prices. Okay. If the euro continues to fall, for example, the UK is a much more open economy. So when sterling falls, as Mark was saying, straight away food prices rise.
Yes.
Europe is self-sufficient in food. We're food exporters, right?
Yeah.
So as the euro falls, the rate of inflation that we import will be much less than in a smaller economy like the UK. So that's number one. Mm. As the euro falls, European exporters will be much more profitable. Number two, to export our way out of growth.
Right.
But as the euro falls, Europeans will become less rich because our purchasing power falls.
Yes. Yeah.
I think that's a much more sensible strategy than trying to follow the Americans. Because if you look at what's happening in America, the American inflation rate is seeping into the economy. So it's gone from manufacturing into services, right? In Europe, still the rate of inflation is very much an energy issue and only an energy issue. Mm. Why? Because the European economy isn't operating at full tilt. Hasn't been for a long, long time.
Yeah.
So there's excess capacity in Europe. So in terms of figuring all this out for the average person, if you're an Irish person and you've just bought a house,
yeah,
or you've got a mortgage,
yeah,
right? Which is basically lots and lots of people listening to the show.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got a mortgage, mortgage rates are going to rise and they're going to rise very, very quickly.
Yeah.
So whatever you were paying last month, you're going to be paying much more next month or next year in 6 months' time. House prices have to fall in a situation of a doubling of interest rates, maybe a tripling of interest rates, even if we could, right?
Yeah.
So what we're looking at is a serious, difficult winter. And there is an outside chance, but it could become mainstream, of what happened to the UK happening to the pension funds in Europe, which is why the ECB won't raise rates, because they also recognize that what happened to the UK could happen to us. The only difference we'll end here is the UK depends on the kindness of strangers. And by that, I mean the UK finances itself with foreign money.
Yeah.
So the UK runs an 8% balance of payments deficit, which basically means the Brits are spending money on the never never. Right?
Yeah.
Their living standard, as I always say, is rented, not earned. Mm. Now, who have they rented it from? They've rented it from people who invest in UK government gilts, right?
Yeah.
So they have to keep the rest of the world on side. The European Union runs a balance of payments surplus. We internally finance our own deficits. So we're not in the same position.
Right. Okay.
So we depend on ourselves. The UK depend on the kindness of strangers. But ultimately, what we're looking at is, and we've seen it before, we saw the crash in Ireland. We saw the banking meltdown, right?
Yes.
We've seen this picture before. And I think we're at the very beginning of what could be an equally similar year of carnage in financial markets. And to get back to Bernanke, money matters. John.
Yes.
There's always a silver lining. Who doesn't like blue skies and bumblebees and lovely songs about summer and love and the way of the world? We can always depend on art. This is the proud dad moment. Lucy's newest single, Bumblebees and Blue Skies. Take it away, Lucy.
Turn around and watch you walk away. You say we're better on our own. But then I'll miss you when you're gone. I don't want anyone else besides you, beside me.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.